Every front door unopened, every trip unmade, every overtapped snooze button, every commute from bedroom to kitchen table, every click, every call, every meeting. Everyone who can and does work from home is helping stop the spread of COVID-19, because the less we leave home, the less likely we'll come into contact with the virus. Everything we're doing is making a difference. Let's keep going. Stay home, protect the NHS, save lives.
Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name's Adam Brimelow, and we're doing a series of discussions on COVID-19 one year on. In this episode, we speak to Siobhan Melia, Chief Executive at Sussex Community NHS Foundation Trust, Richard Mitchell, Sherwood Forest Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust Chief Executive, and Saffron Cordery, NHS Providers Deputy Chief Executive, about the impact of the pandemic on the NHS workforce and the importance of dealing with inequalities within the NHS. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers. And keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you. Even before the pandemic, the NHS workforce held a special place in public affection and respect. But that's been really reinforced and strengthened as staff have responded to the challenges of dealing with COVID-19. We've seen a great outpouring of gratitude for their commitment, compassion, their resilience and resourcefulness, often in the face of exhaustion, loss, bereavement and burnout. We owe them so much. But even as the immediate operational pressures posed by the pandemic start to recede, it's all too clear that the legacy of COVID for the NHS workforce will loom large for years to come. No question, there are some key lessons to learn from the last 12 months. So Richard, Siobhan and Saffron, thank you for joining us on the Provider Podcast to reflect on what's happened and where we go next to support and strengthen the workforce to meet future needs. I think it might be worth just turning the clock back to the start of the pandemic in some ways, reminding ourselves how stretched the workforce was coming off the back of winter last year. Richard, just reflecting back to that time, how difficult were things in terms of the workforce being overstretched at that point, and how did that affect the ability to respond?
Thanks, Adam. So much has happened over the last 12 months. It can be difficult to remember where we were 12 months ago. Clearly, and people were very tired and we were all running with high levels of vacancies. I think collectively, the way we approached the beginning of the pandemic on reflection was really wise. So obviously, the national attention turned to prioritising and focusing on patients with COVID, continuing emergency care pathways, mental health pathways and cancer pathways. And because of that, that meant that we could reduce our bed occupancy, we could reduce the volumes of patients that we were treating, and it meant that we could redeploy staff. And I think that redeployment of colleagues was also important. Collectively, and organisations from very early on focused on the welfare and wellbeing, which I think was equally as important. And many organisations were able to strengthen their provision of our through the staff bank. So I think it was those mechanisms that enabled us to begin the process of responding to the pandemic effectively. But I think the challenge we're facing now is probably greater than the challenge we faced 12 months ago.
And how were things set for you, Siobhan, as we went into this pandemic? Obviously, severe shortages in community services as well.
Yes, I mean, I guess the one difference for the community sector was that there was a national decision to stand down quite large numbers of children's services in particular in the first wave. So the point around redeployment and availability of staff was not a problem that we faced immediately. Yes, people were tired after the winter, but I think we didn't quite know what to expect March, April, May time. And when the national decision was taken, for example, to stand down the delivery of universal health visiting services, and to redeploy those staff into the adult-based services. We probably found ourselves better staffed in some of our community rehabilitation hospitals, in our urgent community response teams than we had ever been. So actually, there is an uptick of resource available at the back of the winter that actually hadn't been available for those adult services all the way through. As I say, it had some other consequences and impacts, but it gave us the resources at that point in time in March, April, May.
I suppose, Saffron, in terms of other areas where the pandemic made a really quick impact, certainly in terms of pressure on ambulance services, also mental health as well, a continuing theme right through the pandemic. It's been really sort of cross-sector, hasn't it?
I think the very nature of a pandemic is that it, you know, it's got tentacles, hasn't it? And it reaches into every part of, you know, not just every part of the health system, but every part of people's lives, and therefore reverberates back into those public services that people use. And I think we really saw that. I remember conversations around the NHS Providers Board table at the beginning of the pandemic, where that massive uptick in the 999 and 111 rates just going through the roof, literally. It's the very definition of the word exponential rise, isn't it? When we look at how this impacted in terms of numbers of calls and pressures on staff in particular and on mental health. I think it's one of those ones, probably a bit like community services, that have flown more under the radar because they're not the first thing that we think about when we think about how has the pandemic impacted. But of course, people's pre-existing mental health conditions don't go away. They may well be exacerbated during a pandemic because, you know, loneliness, socioeconomic deprivation, all sorts of worklessness, different job situations all come into play, which exacerbate people's conditions, and also those who really need help not coming forward for it. It doesn't mean that they don't have problems that need to be dealt with. And I think we saw a lot of the kind of almost like a restructuring of how help was needed and sought by people who were using mental health services. But it certainly, the demand didn't go away. But at the same time, mental health trusts were redeploying their staff to support acute trusts as well, where it was needed. So, you know, there was the very immediate focus on that real and present danger, which was the pandemic. One other point, just thinking back at a year ago, more than a year ago, back to February, I remember I was hosting a dinner with a very senior person from a central organisation who basically just said, things are really tricky at the moment. You know, winter's been difficult. We have all of these vacancies. We've got a big job to do in terms of, you know, transforming the NHS, where we go next. A lot of, you know, backlog was already existing then. Capital was a very, very big issue. But then they did say, but if this pandemic that we're hearing about strikes, then all bets are really off. And that's just stayed in my head for the whole of this period about what does all bets being off really mean. And I think we've just seen that roll out. And I just think testament to staff across the NHS and leadership across the NHS about what that actually means and has looked like, because all bets are off has actually meant that the service has coped despite huge pressures.
Yeah, so all bets were off. It was a difficult starting point for many services. One of the things that really struck me, and you mentioned it there, Saffron, was the willingness of staff to adapt, to change their roles, to learn new skills, to work in different environments, in some ways responding in ways that probably couldn't have been imagined ahead of the pandemic. Richard, how quickly did you come to realise and recognise the willingness of staff to respond in extraordinary ways to deal with this emergency?
In the Midlands, we've had three discrete waves of COVID, and I wasn't surprised in the first wave about people's ability to be redeployed and to adapt, because maybe I'm naive, but I think the world is populated by wonderful people, and certainly the NHS is. You've got the most brilliant people who want to make a difference, and they were willing to be redeployed into the most sort of frightening and traumatic circumstances and experiences that you can imagine. What I think I was surprised about is, given the impact that these people faced over the sort of three, four, months of the initial wave and that trauma and the psychological impact? Was their willingness in the second wave, in the third wave, to go back to something that was really challenging and they hadn't psychologically, they hadn't been able to recalibrate and get to grips with it? And as Saffron was saying, COVID has fundamentally changed our working lives and it's certainly changed our personal lives. So I was amazed and certainly very grateful that colleagues were willing to go back. And I think that the final bit for me, what has been a positive about this is when you talk to colleagues who've worked here for, say, 15, 20 years, they'll reference that they've seen someone across the car park every day for 15 years. They haven't said hello to, they don't know who that person is. And then they've found themselves working side by side with them. And they're truly meaningful and very strong relationships have come out of the most difficult circumstances.
Yeah, and so many uplifting anecdotes we've heard. I just wonder, Siobhan, though, whether you have any sense of a looming reckoning in terms of the sacrifices that people have been asked to make in terms of the commitment to their work, given the duration of the pandemic and the sheer physical exhaustion as well.
We put together some online training and capability and competence support very, very quickly. It was one of the digital transformations that I think we've almost forgotten about, the magnitude of online clinical support and training that we created. But there was definitely some fear, and I think that contributed to the exhaustion. People very much out of their areas of professional comfort zone, concerned at that point also around personal protective equipment and a range of other risk factors that were emerging. So I think looking at our staff survey results actually and breaking it down into analysis of some of those large cohorts of our workforce that were redeployed, it's clear that there has been an impact. I think fatigue is one element of it, as you said, Adam, but you know, some of the questions around being able to deliver the top quality of care for your patients have reduced for us this year. And I think when I look at the narrative behind it, I totally understand that some groups of the population, patients, adults, children, families, were held for a period of time without access to the teams that normally look after them. And then other areas of staff, such as our musculoskeletal physiotherapists who were redeployed, they're now feeling really tired, but have come back into their service with quite significant waiting lists. So are feeling as though they're looking for that sort of, you know, how do they re-energize? How do they go from leaving the service, contributing to the greater good around the COVID patients that we were dealing with, but going back to a service now with exponentially larger waiting lists? So I think there are a number of factors that are driving people's experience, but there is definitely an overwhelming sense of fatigue due to the longevity of the experience. I would agree with that.
Yeah, and I suppose as a background to this, there is of course the people plan, the priorities set out there, including health and well-being, flexible and remote working, bringing staff back from retirement and upskilling. Saffron, how much do you think the experience of the pandemic has gone with the grain and helped to bring forward the people plan, or is it something that's been overtaken by events in some ways?
I think it's one of those things, isn't it, where, you know, if the priorities of a plan are the right ones, then we will see them playing out in the day-to-day service. So I think that there is a lot in the people plan that is actually rolling out. So that focus on health and well-being, that focus on how do we work differently and in different ways, how do we redeploy people, upskill them, all of those elements which are fundamental to any good workforce plan anyway are playing out. Whether or not we badge them as the people plan is another question. And I think that particularly in the full force of a pandemic, we aren't thinking about how we trace back to, did this originate in the people plan? If it's a good idea, if it's working well, then it's going to be there. And I think quite a lot of the underpinning of the people plan and its thinking is about supporting staff, recognizing staff as being fundamental to delivering a high quality service. You know, a happy member of staff makes a higher quality service. I think you can't kind of divorce those elements from people plan itself. It's all in there and playing out. I think that what I would observe is that now isn't the time necessarily to focus on, have a big fanfare on a piece of paper that says the people plan. It's about the underlying principles and rolling that out. I think, in a sense, what has been difficult about the pandemic has been the way that progress in different areas has been slowed, and also investment has been reprioritized. So I'm sure that the bit where we might want to see a quickening of the pace would be around how we start to invest more effectively in the workforce. And I don't want to preempt any conversation we might have about reward, but that would certainly be in there, which is a properly rewarded workforce is one very good way of investing in them. So I think it's all there. I think that it needs greater investment, but that we shouldn't judge it by whether it was heralded as a great new thing in the year of a pandemic. All of those themes were there and rolling out.
I think one demand it undoubtedly created, though, was the requirement for good leadership in terms of the pressures your staff, your workforce were under, Richard and Siobhan. What sort of innovations, what sort of changes, approaches did you bring to bear to keep things going through these extreme times? Perhaps I could start with you, Siobhan.
My reflection on the first sort of 6-7 months of the pandemic last year was there was a fair bit of intuition, I think, in my decision making. I don't think that there was a blueprint to follow in this set of circumstances. I had a few principles at the forefront of my mind. One was being a visible leader, and that's quite a challenge in a very, very geographically dispersed organisation in a national lockdown. So we use technology in ways that we hadn't before, and that's a common thread across the whole NHS. But on a personal level, I decided to do weekly videos for the first 8 weeks of the pandemic. And I considered on a Sunday what I would say on a Monday. And I found myself digging quite deep about the type of messaging that was a combination of being honest, but calm and hopeful. And there wasn't much data, evidence or facts to draw on at that point. I got very good feedback from my organisation about the impact of those videos. And I think there was something fairly raw and authentic about how we put them together that gave people a sense of leadership, visible leadership in a constrained environment in which we were operating.
And Richard, was that the same for you? Did you have to dig deep as a leader to support colleagues through this time?
Really making it clear the sense that this is about a team. So whilst I'm the chief exec in the organisation, it's really important for my own sanity and also for the organisational benefits that we work together. And on reflection, what was fascinating was the near and the long-term future was unclear. We were taking decisions on a Monday that we might have to change on a Wednesday or a Thursday. So that communication piece was absolutely clear. People wanted information. Ideally, they wanted an answer, but we didn't have the answers. So acknowledging that this was a challenge and we were trying to work our way through, I think, was really important. Obviously, the visible leadership was made more difficult because of the restrictions of COVID, but where possible, having those face-to-face interactions with people, setting up and changing our governance to be far more agile and making decision-making easier for people, giving people the answers to, can we purchase this? Yes, you can. I think that all worked well. But also showing levels of personal vulnerability. We've all discussed about how COVID transformed our working lives, but it's the only example of something I can think of that is a real challenge at work, that you don't get the sanctuary from home because you're going home and there's literally nothing to do. You're not seeing people, all of the things that are important to you. So I felt it's as a senior leader, it's important to be hopeful and optimistic and try and offer a way in which the organisation can chart its way through this. But equally, I think just being overly hopeful and positive doesn't resonate with people. It's important that I acknowledge on the days or the weeks when things weren't going to plan, or maybe showing some stuff that I thought was meaningful about my personal life. I think that goes back to the idea about it's okay not to be okay. Also acknowledging when we didn't get things right, I look back and I think, why on earth did we take this decision? But for me, probably about this time last year, I think it was on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and suddenly there was the news about you need to get people working from home. Well, on reflection, why did I send an email out to people at 11 o'clock in the morning saying you need to go home now? That was a crazy thing to do. That was poor communication, and it made it made people more anxious about something that they would be anxious about. So we apologized for that and we learned from it. And I think the learning from that we've put in place in our other decisions. And then the final thing, because that's all within the lens of an organization, it's about communicating and listening to peers in other organizations or other parts of the country. Or we're struggling with this issue with a PPE perspective or restrictions in the organizations or visiting. How have you gone about this? And I think the NHS is still not particularly fantastic about sharing best practice or even the learning. And I certainly think it's important to recognise the decision that I'm taking today is highly likely that somebody else has taken that decision yesterday or the day before and learning from that.
So one key area of concern with the pandemic, as you know, has been in terms of health inequalities, exclusion and discrimination. We certainly see that in the NHS as well as in wider society. Siobhan, how are you addressing those concerns in the work that you do?
We were in the throes of establishing an executive group to focus on equality, diversity and inclusion in a slightly different way in the trust. And I guess the pandemic almost expedited our thinking on it. So we've got a committee chaired by me, which now brings together health inequalities through the lens of both our staff and our patients, but importantly, the populations that we serve and that we, the communities that we wish to link more meaningfully into. So we recognise that there wasn't an executive level part of the organisation that brought those two facets together. We had a lot of work on patient experience and accessing harder to reach groups. But I think what COVID did was certainly magnified the focus on inequalities amongst our staff group, with a view to hearing the lived experience of a range of colleagues across the trust. I continued to engage virtually with the group throughout the year of the pandemic. And actually many of the things that were troublesome to hear before the pandemic were probably magnified through the pandemic. The magnification of some of the issues, certainly as an exec leadership team, placed some of this much higher up our agenda. Sort of goes back to that, how do we govern, not with too much bureaucracy, do you know, there's this sort of agile governance approach that I think has the NHS has benefited from through the pandemic. But at the same time, if you're not bringing together the right people to have the conversations and holding to account the action plans through the lens of inequalities in a broader sense, I think it's hard to point to any difference that we're making. Honestly, I think we're still in the foothills of addressing health inequalities. I hate that in some of the structural changes that come with the legislation for the NHS, that the public health leadership and the public health voice is much closer to the provider sector. In my organisation, we employed a public health consultant for that very reason, that there are expertise around reducing health inequalities that exist. I think in recent years, the public health leadership voice has been pulled a little far away from the provider interface. And I think if that can be redressed, we could probably go faster on health inequalities.
Richard, I remember you speaking very powerfully about racial discrimination at our annual conference last year. This is clearly an issue that's very close to your heart and that you think about a great deal as you go about your work.
I hope so. As Siobhan was saying, the organisation I work in, we'd certainly made progress pre-pandemic, both in terms of discrimination, inequalities. But the pandemic has drawn much needed to attention to this. So we have focused on the work of our networks, whether it's colleagues from minority communities or colleagues in the LGBT network or others. We've taken practical steps, I believe, to strengthen the voice of colleagues. So the organisation I work in is similar to Siobhan's. We have very informal weekly virtual briefing, and increasingly as things have settled down, I've been joined by someone in the organisation who's got different experiences to me, and we use it as an opportunity to listen to them and listen to their lived experiences. It was incredibly sad, probably about 6-9 months ago, we held one of our networks events and to listen to colleagues about their lived experiences in the organisation and in their personal life. So whilst colleagues felt that we weren't a racist organisation, they did experience micro inequalities. They certainly on a regular basis experienced racism from patients, and they felt, and I wouldn't deny it, that we had accepted that. And then where we work and where we live, it's very homogenous here, and they would be experiencing incredibly hurtful racist comments on a day-to-day basis. And that made me reflect about actually my experiences and thoughts about this organisation are different to others. We have a problem here like other people. I think we've made progress, but there's lots more work to do. I think that just the final point for me, the bit that I think we've moved on around this is about recognising the acute deprivation that some of our colleagues experience. We've got three hospitals across Mid-Nottinghamshire. We've been doing a piece of work about looking at where people work. And I was shocked to find out that 27% of colleagues who work at Sherwood, often in full-time employment, are living in 20% of electoral wards that have the highest levels of deprivation. And so there's a real sense of there's more we need to be doing as a good employer to help people here. And I think that's through the lens of if you help people, it enables them to do a good job. It also impacts on their personal life. And we know that the 5,500 people who work here are a fairly large proportion of the local population. So we have made progress, but not nearly enough. And we have to recognise, to be honest, the starting point was fairly low.
One of the big workforce dilemmas that's really come to the fore just in the last few weeks, which is to do with vaccine hesitancy and the question of compulsory vaccination. Obviously, it's a hugely complex issue on lots of levels. Perhaps, Siobhan, I could ask you, do you take a strong stance on this, either for or against the idea of compulsory vaccination?
I think that we need to seek to understand further and in a more meaningful way why there is this degree of vaccine hesitancy around the COVID vaccine. It's a vaccine that was put together very, very quickly. I understand some of the nervousness about it, but talking to some of my senior doctors at work, there are reasons that people are hesitant that I don't understand. And I think we have a duty to seek to understand with more depth so that we can influence decision making at this point. In the future, I can see a landscape where it's a contractual obligation for frontline staff to have undertaken a number of vaccinations. I'm a clinician by background, and I certainly remember having to have my occupational health visit and my inoculations to be a clinician when I first joined the NHS. So I can see that there's precedent set around a number of roles that require mandatory vaccinations. I think it's difficult at this point when it's not currently a contractual obligation, and we don't know enough about why our people are exhibiting this degree of hesitancy. And I'm not sure we've had the time to influence more positively their decisions.
Any thoughts on this from you, Richard?
I would agree with that. I think at the moment, mandating it or making it compulsory would be certainly unnecessary, and I think it would be unhelpful. And with Siobhan, I think it's important here to listen to the concerns of people, the hesitancy about having a vaccination that's involving new science that's only been around now for a couple of months is completely understandable. I think getting to the root concerns and understanding that and explaining and providing assurance and reassurance, I think, is the way through this. So we know the organisation I work in, 9 out of 10 people have chosen to have the vaccine so far, which is great. And I think what's probably more important than that is if you cut into it by our three sites or by clinical or non-clinical or by age or by shielding or ethnicity, every single group in the organisation is up at around 86% or higher. And I think that's because we've been able to work and convey the importance of this. And also where people are understandably concerned, I think we've taken some steps to try and provide them some reassurance.
Another key issue here is pay. And obviously there was a really strong reaction, wasn't there, to the government's proposal of 1% uplift. Saffron, I know this was something that we were very keen to comment on publicly.
Yeah, absolutely. So we certainly at a national level felt that it was not only, well, wrong, I'll say it. It was wrong to come out with not only that offer, but also to come out with it at that timing as well, when we are in a situation where, as Richard and Siobhan have so clearly articulated, where staff are still under extreme pressure. They've played a blinder over the last year. We're going to need them to play a blinder for the years to come, to then be facing a pay offer which is below the rate of inflation and doesn't really offer a sign of value or reward for what they're doing. I think it was incredibly difficult, particularly, and this was very much our argument, particularly when we knew that the assumptions that underpinned the settlement for the NHS back in 2018 were for around a 2.1% pay increase at least. That makes it incredibly difficult. I mean, we certainly have said that we, following a survey of trust HR directors and leaders, have said we think at least 3%. If you go and talk to unions, they will be saying probably 4 or 5 times that. But obviously there is an affordability balance to be struck there. But I do think that this is a fundamental issue. We know pay isn't everything. A manageable role in a workplace that shows compassion passion and listens to you, and a job that fulfills many needs is absolutely critical. But I think what Richard talked about earlier in terms of thinking about the conditions, some of paying conditions that some NHS staff work for, and what that means in terms of their lives and where they live and how they live, it's not that we are talking about 1% on some very large, very rich salaries. We're talking about 1% on salaries which are at the bottom end very often, and people look for other things in their jobs. So we shouldn't take advantage of that, I think, is my view.
Well, Saffron, Siobhan, Richard, fascinating talking to you about these workforce issues and the pandemic. Thank you so much for talking to us on the Provider Podcast.